Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, where we have more witches in this episode of Ahsoka, and perhaps the greatest verbal kickoff to a Star Wars episode ever. With me tonight to discuss Far, Far Away is Stephen Tollefield and Thomas Harper. Stephen, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. Really glad to be here to talk about this episode. It's really exciting.
Tom, are you okay? Can you contain yourself?
I haven't been on Twitter in a long time, but I had a couple people reach out and check on me. My one ask last week, I won't call it a prediction, but my beg of the universe came true. So we got to see the Chimera in dramatic fashion.
Artwork.
Yes.
So beautiful.
Can't leave that
So let me talk boat and shipbuilding from what I. From what I know
out.
from my hobbies, she got Chimera got pretty beat up from the port engines gone. Gone. They had to rebuild stuff. That they got beat up by those whales, and God knows what else that they fought with for 10 years in the other galaxy. So rough life, but it was great seeing a ship that they've tried taking care of. Like they clearly have put effort into maintaining that vessel, there's just not the replacement parts, which is why you have that gold medal instead in places where, again, whales grabbed on for that jumped up hyperspace and beat the snot out of that Star Destroyer. Just so well done. Raises the issue, what happened to the other two? Did they cannibalize them? Are they, did they go like, we're done? Bye. We're gonna go.
Sorry, did you say which kingdom? I think we're gonna go over here.
Yeah.
We'll just be on patrol over in
Right.
this other area.
I'm out. They just noped right out of that.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. So. My service is over, so we'll see you guys never. So, all right, let's get into all of this. One of the big issues out of the gate is contract performance. Sabine had an agreement with Baylan. We call that a contract. She gave him the map in order for being able to see Ezra again, which meant hitching a ride so she could go. She ends up as a prisoner in the process. But Thrawn ultimately honors their deal, mostly. Stephen, do you want to take the first swing at this and whether or not there's a valid contract at play?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a val so the there's offer and acceptance. I guess the problem that I was seeing with it was that you could make an argument from Sabine's point of view that there was a dis non-disclosure of a material term of the agreement,
Yeah.
which was
Assassination.
if we perform this contract, we will kill you. So that might be something that she would argue against performance of that contract or obligations under that contract. But it's funny how courts, I mean, obviously that's a very extreme sort of, fictional example, I would hope, but generally courts don't really obligate parties to be too transparent in their contract negotiations. There's usually a duty for parties to do their own due diligence and kind of anticipate potential pitfalls in the arrangements, and it's not the other party's obligation to necessarily reveal to them all of the markups that they're putting into their product, for example. So, but this sort of thing might be the kind of thing where Sabine would say, you sort of left that part out. I think I would rather not give you the map thing at this point. And by the way, this happens all the time in stores. It's like every story has non-disclosure of material terms and contracts, like going back to A New Hope, where Obi-Wan and Luke are negotiating for fare on the Millennium Falcon and sort of omit the the important detail that they are on the run from the Empire when Han Solo specifically says, "I don't want any Imperial entanglements." So there's a lot of weird contract negotiations that happen in Star Wars, and this is just another example.
I do like that Thrawn. This is like probably the most classic Thrawn moment of the entire episode, where he makes the comment that no, they will fulfill the term, their end of the bargain, which is letting her see Ezra. And so in Thrawn's like very calculating surgical mind, the contract will have been completed, the performance is done. You just die after that point, like immediately after.
Yeah, I guess they would just say that that's not part of the deal, really.
Yeah,
That's just the next step.
it's just business.
He's a bad man. That's could justify an anticipatory breach.
It stood out to me, though, the sort of the foundation of contract law gets is sort of on display in a weird way in this episode, because you have Shin of all people that expresses concern that they're not going to fulfill the deal, and so that our whole concept of this entire body of law is built on the idea that if you make a deal, if you give up something and another part, you need to get what you bargained for. You need to get that consideration in return. And I thought it was fascinating that after sort of this hard edge, like cold character shows a little bit of emotion about like, whoa, we better do what we promised we would do. And I wonder, story wise, if that portends other things for her future. Maybe these are the seedlings of doubt, perhaps. Although she doesn't hesitate to go off on the assassination mission, so maybe not. Yeah.
I think that puts him squarely in the lawful evil D&D alignments realm. It's interesting how they and did either of you play the Old Republic, the BioWare MMO? You can be a Sith who does makes light side choices. You can have like a evil, like a dark side user who sort of treats people fairly and kind of goes after bad people, like slavers and stuff. So it's like Shin and Baylan are sort of falling into that category for me. It's interesting.
Yeah.
So like the Punisher? Just
Yeah, kind of.
okay. Wow. Yeah, it's a bad sign when, the cutthroat assassin's like, whoa, we're breaching a deal. I'm not comfortable with this. And it actually makes sense. Their business as mercenaries requires them honoring contracts. They're a trust-based profession that we do what we say we're going to do, because if we don't, we're burning our reputation and our ability to get more work. Therefore, we follow our word. Like we have a contract, so we're going to, abide by it.
So, who do you think hired Baylan and Shin? Because I thought that it was, is their contract with
Morgan.
Morgan or with Thrawn? Because I don't, it's interesting because I don't know that Morgan really cares one way or another about Ezra. I would think that Thrawn is the one who would want Ezra dead.
My take is Morgan hired them. Thrawn's a third-party beneficiary, but he seems to be assuming Morgan's contract and her obligations because she delivered and getting the Eye of Sion. So it's, and I don't know if you can go from third-party beneficiary to assume contractual obligations. Conceptually, it makes sense that it could happen. I don't know of examples. Like, I've never seen that in my practice, but I think from a law school hypothetical, it could work.
It's there definitely is some deal of which like a separate deal between Thrawn and maybe Morgan by extension of her status as a Night Sister or Dathomirian. It almost made me think that are Balin and Shin like unwitting subcontractors suddenly? They're carrying out something that Morgan can't do herself, that's part of a deal that Balin and Shin don't really know about, but they're just going to do it.
Yeah, it depends on the nature of the agreement with Morgan, which would violate public policy and not be enforceable. So let's just make sure that's on the table. Murder for hire is not allowed. No.
The U.S. is so
However,
boring. U.S. law.
no. Back in the old days, yeah, no. Like it's against public policy. Now, hiring a bodyguard's okay, but what they're doing is way beyond what a bodyguard would do with going out and killing people. Let's think back to the ship that they broke Morgan out of, which was itself a crime with all kinds of homicide on top of it. So yeah, just not good. But I do like the thought that they're unwitting subcontractors to Thrawn now.
Yeah, they just ride off on the howlers. There is an interesting twist if you consider. So Thrawn would not have been aware, probably, of the fall of the Empire and the terms of any deal struck between the Remnant, or the Galactic Empire, not the Remnant, and the New Republic. And so theoretically, you can make an argument they're still in a state of armed conflict with Ezra. And therefore, apply the law of armed conflict. Thrawn says he's still a combatant, whether he's in hiding doesn't is kind of immaterial, and therefore he can be targeted. The use of a mercenary or the use of a private security contractor, whatever you want to call Balin and Shin, there's no law against that. There'd be ramifications for Balin and Shin, but there wouldn't be any legal exposure for either Morgan or Thrawn for doing that sort of thing. Maybe for Morgan, because she's not really affiliated with any military, but.
A couple examples come to mind for the state of Thrawn and his troopers. One is the Japanese soldiers who didn't accept World War II ended, and there was at least one guy up and through the 1970s or 80s who was hiding out in the mountains in the Philippines, and it was just like refused to accept Japan surrendered. That also ties into the movie Atragon, where bunch of Japanese submariners are on an island building a submarine that could fly for 20 years, just refused to accept the surrender, but they knew about it. Other example is actually a historic one. The Confederate ship Shenandoah, they were a raider that could disguise themselves as a sailing ship and then roll out the guns to go take out whalers and raise hell. Well, they were up in the North Pacific going after Union whalers, unaware that the Civil War had ended. And when they found out, there was a they realized, oh no, we could be hung as pirates. Whoops. So like they made a run to go hide in England so they wouldn't be executed for their crimes on the high seas. So I think the Thrawn falls into that category because they've been removed from the board. They weren't a player. It's not like there was information coming through about Death Star 1, Death Star 2, everything in between, Battle of Jakku. They just don't know any of that. So if, and it's not like the great mother's dreams are being able to fill in the blanks about FYI, this happened while you guys have been hanging out over here. So I do like the combatant status because they just don't know the war's over. So, but there's a lot there. There is a lot there. So, with that said, let's talk about the night troopers. So, quick side note on the great mothers. The lead great mother is played by Claudia Black, of Farscape fame.
Yay, it's what she deserves. God bless.
She's
so
real.
great. I love her.
I mean, I didn't catch it the first time around. I saw articles and then look at it, it's like, oh yeah, that's some heavy makeup, but that's definitely Claudia Black. And Farscape was one of those things that kept me sane through law school. So very, very appreciative of that show and to see her working and with fun characters, because those are creepy, creepy characters right out of the animated series. So good for her.
And speaking of the Troopers, Enoch is played by Wes Chatham, who was on The Expanse. And he's amazing. So I'm very excited to see if they get his helmet to come off. That'd be cool. What's underneath?
Now, there's a lot to break down with the Troopers. So let's take the first issue. And I don't know if you did this, Stephen or Thomas, but do the Night Troopers have a legal duty to continue serving the Empire?
Yeah, I tossed that in there. There's an interesting wrinkle here. So they've been gone 10 years, right? Like they're actively serving in the Imperial military as the Purgil jumped them out of the Lothal system. And it brings up an interesting wrinkle in military service obligations. So just very broadly speaking, in terms of all employment, you could be what we call an at-will employee. So there's no terms to your employment. Your employer can fire you at any time for any reason or no reason. You can quit. You can also be have some sort of you'd be a contractual employee. So you have a written contract that spells out the terms of your employment. Within the military, there are two sort of classes of service members. You have officers who, like Grand Admiral Thrawn, so your higher ranking individuals, they serve under a commission from the President of the United States. And we know in the Star Wars universe, officers attend academies. They presumably earn a commission, I guess, from the Chancellor or the Emperor. I don't know how that, all the details of how it works. But you, there is no end of your term of service, absent aging out or, you know, being medically discharged or something, or a retirement, that sort of thing. So you serve it at the pleasure of the president in the real world, and you can resign at any point once your sort of initial, they call it a military service obligation, which is an 8-year term, typically 4 years active duty, another 4 in some sort of reserve capacity or inactive capacity. But you can just continue on. You don't have to do anything. So like myself, my ADSO, as they call it, was done a long, long time ago, but I haven't had to do anything. I don't have to periodically re-up any contracts or anything. So your officers aboard that Star Destroyer, like Thrawn, would be in that realm. So they could just keep serving and serving with no need to take care of any contract stuff. Enlisted soldiers, however, so you're like your sergeants, your privates, like your lower ranking folks, probably the majority of the Stormtrooper Corps. In the real world, enlisted soldiers are contractual employees. They sign enlistment contracts. You go to the recruiter and hash out the details. How long are you going to serve? Are you going to get a bonus, et cetera, et cetera. And that ends, or there's a defined term of service in there. It's a contractual term. However, the wrinkle here, so under normal circumstances, these stormtroopers probably have enlistment contracts. Those contracts probably would have long expired. There's some nuance to that. But generally speaking, you'd have a lot of these troopers reaching their, what we call an ETS, your end of term of service. And you're out. You hit your ETS date at whatever point in time, and you haven't taken action to sign a new contract to re-enlist. And you're out. You just go your merry way, and you know, you retain whatever benefits you've earned, and that might not include a retirement, but you're done. Interestingly, for the Night Troopers here, I think they would have a legal duty to continue, regardless of what happened with their contracts. There is a real world basis for keeping enlisted soldiers on after their contracts. If you've ever heard of the term stop loss. It was a term that got used a lot in the early days of the Iraq War and the war in Afghanistan, where soldiers would be involuntarily extended either after their retirement date or ETS or maybe their tour in country was supposed to be up and they'd be involuntarily extended. But effectively, it's a mechanism that the power rests with the president, but that's been delegated, that can extend your term of service beyond the contractual end date. That seems a little weird, but it's anchored in this. There's a U.S. code section that came about after the Vietnam War that vested the president with the authority in wartime to involuntarily extend your term of service. And so when you look at the actual Department of Defense form, like the contract, the enlistment form, there is language that says in the event of war, your term of service can, you know, can extend 6 months beyond the war's end or at the discretion of the president. So in Thrawn's mind, the war is still going on. The Empire is still at war with whatever remains of the rebellion, potentially the New Republic. He may not care what form the enemy has taken. They're still the enemy. And so those stormtroopers, I don't want to jump ahead, but assuming they're alive, can be involuntarily stop lost. Practically speaking, they're going to want to stay aboard because, like, if you're like, hey, I'm done, I'm ETSing, be like, okay, go wander the wastes of Peridia and good luck with the raiders out there. But there's a contractual and there's a lawful basis for keeping them on the books.
Great analysis. And boy, there's a lot to unpack with whether or not they know there's their state. The fact that Thrawn makes mention to Sabine about her willing to gamble the safety of their galaxy, perhaps he knows the Empire lost. Or he's just really sure of himself that he can go out and kick some ass and do damage to Rebels or New Republic. But he might know, which is an interesting question.
Yeah, there's some suggestion that the witches can communicate at least on a very rudimentary level with Morgan. They sort of calling to her. Yeah, maybe they do know. It's a good question.
Yeah, or how much do they know? It's like, we just know we lost. Like, because dreams really don't seem that efficient of a way to communicate detailed information other than come get me. But
maybe they could sense the vanquishment of a great darkness in the galaxy. And that's tells them that the Emperor has been defeated, at least temporarily.
We felt him explode. So, yeah.
Yes.
I have to believe, too, that Thrawn, when he makes that comment, he's alluding to something we're not fully aware of. As full of himself as he no doubt is, the idea that he would regard his return alone with one Star Destroyer and a partial crew as the tipping point for the galaxy, I think is a little far-fetched. I think there's some connection in with the deal that he struck with the Great Mothers, whatever they're loading from the catacombs, and whatever he knows of their powers, their plan, etc. So I think there's more to be revealed, hopefully within the next two episodes.
Yeah, there's... I've listened to a few Star Wars podcasts where people were just going off the rails about those are corpses. They all died and they've been reanimated. How about the armor's just beat up? That they've had a really rough time and the ship's held together. Armor's beat up too. That probably a bunch of them died in the jump because numbers dwindled. They don't know who's friend or foe in this new galaxy. So they've probably been fighting a lot against unknown forces. That doesn't mean that he has a crew of zombies that's a cult of personality that chant his name. Why would you give these zombies that kind of autonomy unless you just are really in it for the applause? But that seems weird. I mean, we'll find out soon, but I don't buying to the speculation that everything from the catacombs were stormtrooper corpses waiting to get reanimated. And while Thrawn does say at the end that I might need your dark magic again, that highlights something's afoot. But I don't like the idea that Thrawn's the only living being left on the Star Destroyer and everyone else is a zombie. That we haven't seen everyone. They've probably been low on supplies, take quick hits. I mean, this is more like Battlestar Galactica territory, as in the reboot, not original, where the scarcity is a factor and they lose people left and right and there's no replacements unless you're reanimating corpses, which seems like a huge job. That said, I do love the idea that armor's being held together like Shogun warriors. That's cool.
The red ribbons wrapped around them.
Probably so they don't fall apart.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But also the kintsugi, like the repairs, it's like very artistic. It's so cool looking.
Then in Enoch's face, so there's, I immediately thought of one of the Sinbad movies, Golden Voyage of Sinbad. But there's also Flash Gordon. There's
Gladiator.
Gladiator. Yeah, there's a ton.
Die
of
well.
Yeah, it's, why would a corpse say that? I just, so anyway, I'm sure we'll find out in the next, 30 minutes of that, whether or not they're zombies or not, or it's mixed. But again, I always get nervous with fans just spinning out theories left and right with no basis in reality. It's like, just pump the brakes, but just enjoy it. That said, this raises one of my favorite topics. If you resurrect a corpse, is that desecration of a corpse? I've talked about this a few times. So when it comes to corpse law, we believe in burying the dead as quickly as possible because you want to prevent disease, and there's also the emotional well-being of the family. If you like spill a coffin with, a corpse in it, that can give rise to legal liability, especially if it's in front of all the family members. That can cause emotional distress. So a rich body of law exists with the dead. Here's a case from 1905. Family of the deceased has a legally recognized right to entomb the remains of this deceased family member in their integrity and without mutilation. And that's Coburn v. Patak, 123 Wisconsin, 453-1905. As such, the next of kin have a claim against whoever mutilates a corpse. This is a personal right of the family of the deceased to bury a body and an actionable wrong. And that's Kearney v. Knollwood Cemetery Association, 33 Ohio App, 3rd, 31-36 from 1986. The recognized basis for damages for emotional suffering. And that's also limited to direct blood descendants, as those who have standing to sue. There are also laws about don't go into catacombs and just bring out a corpse. That even extends to like indigenous people burial grounds, that we want the dead to be left buried. You don't get to go exploring and go, look what I found, I'm going to put this on my wall. It's like, you've just committed desecration of a corpse, and there can be additional penalties if you're going after something that's truly like a Native American burial ground as well. So it's a fantastic way to get into lots of trouble and show that you're also a horrible human being. What does this mean for stormtroopers if they're dead and they get reanimated? Is that desecration of a corpse? And I think the test is only if you fail. So if the corpse comes back to life, there's no actionable claim. Now, if it's a scary zombie type situation where it's running around killing people, that's going to upset family members. That they're going to want to have that body re-entombed and not have grandpa try to go on a murder spree. Like, that's a not okay, bad mojo there. However, if the magic goes sideways and the corpse explodes, we absolutely have desecration of a corpse, because you left it in a worse situation. So there's all kinds of bad.
My gosh, that's counterintuitive to me, because it seems like just the movement of something that you expect to be at peace and at rest, like that revulsion would be sufficient to cause the kind of emotional distress in the family. I don't know. Any sense of whether that would be actionable?
Luckily, we don't have this problem in real life, but...
Thank God, yet.
Yes. Right? All those frozen people, if they start coming back, things can get ugly fast.
Or right. are the mushrooms from Last of Us, yeah.
Yeah, good news, we cured them. Oh, this is going to get weird fast. I think there's an argument for it's distressing that the body's been taken out of a tomb. That itself is actionable. However, once the corpse is reanimated, it's no longer a corpse. It's now back to being a living being. Does that negate the cause of action?
Is it a living being, or is it just a body that's being animated by a dark force?
Magics.
These are the questions the law grapples with.
But if the corpse is saying things like, beware of the raiders and die well, that sounds like it has its original personality.
He could be alive and the others are dead. They're very well disciplined zombies, if they're zombies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really... We'll find out. I mean, right now I believe speculation is the path to the dark side. So I really don't like it. But because someone's going to get disappointed and be weird. Like, we've already seen one corpse here that was nobody special. So, yeah.
There's an interesting twist in terms of, like, obviously we don't know that the Dathomiria, the Night Sisters laws, whatever they ascribe to. But culturally, especially from what we've seen in the Clone Wars, they have a very different view of life and death. In fact, we see there's a great set of episodes in the Clone Wars where Grievous launches an assault on Dathomir, and they reanimate the corpses of dead Night Sisters to form this army against the Separatists. And the bodies are stored in these pods. It's clear that this type of magic, the idea of there being this sort of merger point between life and death is ingrained within their culture. So I don't know that they would have, that their society would have laws against that sort of thing for their people. But stormtroopers would obviously be in a different class.
That was a whole boss fight in Jedi Fallen Order too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's super scary.
I died many times in that.
Yeah, it was tough.
Raises the next question. Did Thrawn start a cult? Because no other Imperials cheered for. When Palpatine boarded Death Star 2, there weren't people cheering his name. They were mostly like, how do I not get killed today? And the answer is, I don't know yet, because there's not enough facts. But I think it's a logical conclusion that these troopers and whatever surviving officers have been together for a decade, and their means of survival have been, you know, total faith in Thrawn. It's not surprising if they stuck to it because of, you know, their Grand Admiral, and they've developed a cult of personality around him. Like, that doesn't, you know, chanting the name by itself doesn't make it a cult. But I think it's the first step.
Yeah, and I guess my question is too, is having a cult itself is not illegal, right? There's no crime against you getting people to say that you're the best and you're the savior. And as it, the problem is that often cults, fringe cults, tend to engage in a lot of criminal activities and tend to, you know, abuse people and have all sorts of financial issues. And that's the problem. But of course, with freedom of religion, you can say, everyone worship me now. I'm God's chosen. And that's okay, as long as it doesn't involve any criminal activity, right?
Yeah, but think back to the 90s with the weird doomsday cults for, you know, Hill Bop, where people mutilated themselves.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah, if someone like incites people to violence or self-harm, that's very bad. and maybe what we're seeing with the Kintsugi stormtroopers.
Yeah, go on, Thomas.
No, technically, Josh, it's a peaceful one, but I think there's an argument that you have started a cult.
Josh.
Not
Josh,
one with any zombies.
Josh.
Yeah, I live for the applause at Comic-Con. Yeah, man, totally. No one brings me tribute. No one.
Never say never.
I mean, snacks would be nice. But no. We built a community that doesn't involve chanting. So we got that going for us. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Which brings us to our next topic in this wonderful adventure that I call highway robbery, because Sabine goes out on the road and eventually bandits go after her, and it's like literally robbery on a highway. Looking at a case from 1857 in State v. John 50 NC, so North Carolina 9163 at 169. To constitute the crime of highway robbery, the force must be either before or at the time of the taking and must be of such a nature to show that it was intended to overpower the party robbed or prevent his resisting, and not merely to get possession of the stolen property. So let's break down the facts of what happens here. Sabine has her binoculars, GPS type device. It gets shot out of her hands, she gets shot off the howler, she's on the ground, and then, you know, five or six of these bandits move in on her, clearly with the intent of overpowering her and taking whatever goods that she has. I think this meets the traditional definition of highway robbery. What say you?
I was surprised that this is sort of its own standalone crime. It does strike me as a very 19th century stagecoach situation, where there were probably laws to, you know, sort of any absence of police enforcement of people's travels. There were sort of independent crimes that you could prosecute people for. I would imagine that this sort of thing now would just be kind of merged into assaults and robberies and that sort of thing, but it seems like I guess that they manifest an intent to take stuff from her, or did they just want to kill her?
I think the why waste the energy to just kill someone for being there? I think the ultimate goal was to get whatever good she had. Now, granted, they don't know what Beskar is, but they
counterpoint
know
it is a witch kingdom. And who knows what they do with people?
Yeah, things could get weird fast. So there's that. States have updated these laws. So I didn't do a giant deep dive into all 50 states. But one of the trends that I noticed in like two cases that were more recent dealt more of it with it's like part of your job is transporting goods, like so being a truck driver, and a crime happening to you to get the material that you're hauling.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's in an employment context with the two or three cases I saw from more recent in time. However, the 19th century one looked more like what we just saw. Like it's bandits on the road trying to rob someone, and they do it by trying to overpower her. Because that's what they do. Thomas, anything to add to this?
No, although I honestly, that lightsaber was, she was asking for it, wearing that saber around. I would have probably tried to commit highway robbery, take that hilt.
So first off, I just ordered that last night, since
Oh,
they
nice.
yeah,
Very
they
nice.
I didn't get the ghost, so I felt okay with that kind of throwdown with I can justify this. My birthday was not long ago. I'm a good person. So yeah, it's a sweet looking lightsaber. And it will look good with the rest that I have. However, you're still not in the will, Thomas. But the issue of being on the road, I don't think that's an like attracting. It's, that wasn't like she was asking to get robbed because she was wearing a lightsaber.
No,
She was
no.
on a howler and they wanted food and whatever goods that she had.
Yeah, and I like the idea. We've talked about train robberies in the past, and like the context of Solo and Book of Boba Fett. And you have these laws that crop up because these crimes are an issue at the time, and so you see this identification of a gap in the law, or maybe a desire to increase the deterrence. So you have the creation of crimes like this, oftentimes with increased punishments and whatnot, to try to deter that conduct from happening, try to rein in that unlawfulness that's persisting.
Yeah, and this was a problem centuries ago. It's
Now,
different now.
different in that we could talk on another podcast about that form of highway robbery that is the prices that Hasbro charges for some things, but that's very different analysis.
They do the Lord's work. I am grateful for our friends at
Can't get my clones anywhere else. I have to.
Hasbro. Do you see this magnificent collection? Yeah, it's pretty cool. These guys rock. Now, I would think, Thomas, you added this issue of what's Ezra's legal status? Is it AWOL? Is it desertion? I added, is it missing in action and it was presumed killed in action? Was that you who brought this in?
Yeah, it was. Only because it's an unusual thing. We've talked about one unusual concept with the military tonight, so might as well make it two. And that is that you always have a legal status as an active duty soldier. You're presumed sort of always on duty, regardless of whether you're on leave or in some other off duty, technically at your house sleeping or whatever. You're 24/7 on the job, as far as the law is concerned. So that baseline status is that you're an active soldier, right? So Ezra, at the time of his departure from the galaxy, was a commander in the rebellion. So he's an active duty soldier for the rebellion with a commission as an officer. There are only a handful of categories of status. You always have to have a status legally, and the vast majority of soldiers serve their entire time in a singular status. But if you go away without permission, you can be placed into something like absence without leave, so that's AWOL. Desertion, which is basically absence without leave with the intent to remain away. You also have maybe more commonly known statuses like missing in action, which is you've involuntarily absented yourself, usually within the ambit of some combat operation. Killed in action, that's an obvious one, and a prisoner of war is another status. Here, I think it's pretty obvious that Ezra involuntarily absented himself from the galaxy. Like, I don't think he's not jumping with the Purrgil because he doesn't want to be with the rebellion anymore. Like, they're treating him unfairly. He's doing this as a brave heroic act, and to help save Lothal and save the rebellion, right? So I think he's in an MIA status. Josh, you mentioned the an like a slight variation on those statuses called PKI, which is presumed killed in action. And basically, after a certain period of time or certain set of circumstances, you could be presumed to have died. This was a huge thing in World War One. You had thousands upon thousands of soldiers who died, but were never identified. You actually have an entire commission that was set up out of Great Britain, the War Graves Commission, to help identify the dead or deal with that problem. Famously, Rudyard Kipling, the author of Jungle Book, his son died in an unidentified state. So this is something that sort of we've grappled with. What's clear here is that the rebellion or the New Republic doesn't consider Ezra dead yet. It seems like they've maybe given up some hope in finding him, but it doesn't seem like they've presumed him to be dead, like in an official lawful capacity.
Dad does.
That's true. I mean, but is that like he doesn't have a formal, well, I don't know what he's a senator, but I don't know what his formal role is. Like, in other words, there doesn't seem to be a declaration. It's not as if Mon Mothma said, hey, he's presumed killed in action. Like, you cannot do this on that basis. They think it's a fool's errand based on thin evidence. But, you know, there seems to be some understanding there that, yeah, maybe he's alive, but the prospect of finding him is just really, really difficult. So I think that 10-year time span, if we're talking real world, probably would move him into the territory of being eligible for a PKIA status. But interestingly, you still accrue like all the benefits like pay and leave. So your paid time off, your housing allowance, all those things still accrue while you're gone. So Ezra's got like a healthy back paycheck coming to him whenever. Well, he's, I love the moment where he's like, I can't wait to get back home to the galaxy. And Sabine just like, But when he does make it back, he's got a significant accrual of benefits.
There, growing up in the 80s, in the post-Vietnam era, there is, you know, significant familial stress over the MIAs from the Vietnam War in the issue of, like, what happened to them. You know, were they kept? Were they shipped off to the Soviet Union? What happened to those service members? And, you know, that's something that's haunted people. You know, to our nation's credit, like, we do go out of our way to find remains and identify them. And, you know, there's news articles, you know, a couple times a year, at least once a year, about, you know, World War II remains being identified. So, like, it's a little obnoxious for those New Republic senators seeming eager to write off Ezra's life, because that's bad for morale. You can make a sacrifice play and no one will come to save you. Sends a bad message for all service members, which is why Hera goes rogue. So, but there's a lot to unpack there. Finally, I think, Stephen, you added the last one. Am I correct with this topic?
No, that was me. I care about Pergil. Oh, Stephen, okay. Is...
Who doesn't?
I want a plushie. I mean, like, they gotta... Exactly. There's going to be plushies because, you know, you go to Disneyland, they got wampas and tauntauns and banthas. You know there's going to be Pergil soon.
Please, yeah.
And Hasbro Labs will have the 6-foot one at some point in time.
That you can put a full-size Jedi cruiser inside of. Comes with the attachment.
Lights up, the tentacles expand. Yeah, it'll be beautiful. You know, it'll be as easy to use as the USS flag from G.I. Joe. So, yes, we'll have tons of fun. But tell us about shooting at mammals or whales.
Yeah, so in a word, it's lawful, right? So this is, again, we're going to place this in the context of an armed conflict. And certainly the backdrop here is that that order is given after they receive intelligence that a Jedi is coming. So Ahsoka Tano is on her way in. Thrawn knows that, that Peridia is the endpoint for these Purrgil and that she's likely riding on one. And so there's a real and honest threat as he perceives it, and I think a reasonable one at that, even though he knows, it seems like he doesn't know everything about Ahsoka because he asks for all that, that intel on her. Interestingly, as important as animals are, they really don't, not really, they don't have any specific protections at all under the law of armed conflict. That's sort of a more controversial point today because animals are really particularly vulnerable in armed conflict and they always have been. They're often killed in droves for, you know, either indiscriminately or they're killed for a reason, you know, food or something like that for soldiers. But the bottom line is that that they suffer alongside human beings. But IHL, Law of Armed Conflict, was developed at a time where protection, legal protections for animals weren't really a thing. You're talking the early part of the 20th century. And so IHL as a whole is really anthropocentric. I'm probably butchering that, but it's too late. My brain's not working well. But you have human-focused laws, right? And there may be an effort to try to bend these in the direction of expanding protections, but you look at places like the African continent, places where conflict has happened, like Zimbabwe, where large numbers of endangered species and wild animals are. And unfortunately, IHL doesn't extend those protections. Maybe one day, so the Purrgil are kind of in trouble there. Although it sounds like maybe they come to this place to die anyhow. So
yeah, I don't. They can. It can be more than one thing. Like if they're going back and forth often, like it doesn't have to be a one way trip. They could be, you know, breed there. They're born there, or it could be a migratory pattern that they have. And it does include dying there. So I don't, it could be more than a whale graveyard. But.
Well, Thrawn will assist them with that.
Yeah, it's just, I think a really brutal see a Star Destroyer open fire on a Purrgil, but I could see them being a little sensitive to Purrgil going forward. So, live and learn. So, lot in this episode. And it was a ton of fun. And I gotta say, I do like the early premieres because I'll watch it twice. And
early for you. You West Coasters.
I know. But again, you're still like in bed before midnight. So like that's a good thing.
Tell that to the two little children upstairs who are gonna wake up at 5 something and demand immediate attention.
Are they gonna tackle you? Yeah,
two little Ewoks.
Yeah, well, you know, they're little walking war criminals, so there's a
it's true.
Yes, they are. All right, so with that, gentlemen, thank you. Everyone who's tuned in, thank you for your time. We do appreciate reviews. It helps people to find the show. Share us on social media. And we will be back. So wherever you are, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay geeky. Take care now.